This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. All right, continuing on with the 2025 Eugene Environmental Film Festival. This is the Regenerative Agriculture Workshop and Beer with filmmaker Kelly Salloway. Come sample Deschutes Brewery Organic Patagonia Kenza beer during an insightful workshop by Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Kelly Salloway, highlighting the environmental impact of perennial grains and regenerative agriculture. And then I've got an old interview I did with the Revenuer, with Terry Wilhelm of the Revenuer from 2008 that I did with killradio.org. So enjoy. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. I should point out that the first film was about the perils of self-sufficient farming and how difficult it is. And the second one was on a grain called Kernza that is much more sustainable than wheat. And for more information, as always, you can go to EugeneEnvironmentalFilmFestival.org.
So if each of you just want to go down and kind of introduce yourselves and what film you're in and anything you want to start with.
Okay. I think you all know who I am. I'm Lara, and I'm in The Hard Part.
I'm Dana, and I made the film The Hard Part with Lara.
Okay.
I'm Kelly Salloway. I'm the producer and director of Beer Saves the World. I'm with a film group called Perennial Films out of San Diego. And we want you to ask us lots of questions about beer. We're gonna do some stuff about the film. And then as soon as we're finished with that, we're going to take over and really get more in depth about the actual beer itself, which brings me to this guy.
And hi, I'm Brandon Miller. I'm a certified Cicerone, which essentially is like a beer expert, like a wine sommelier, but for beer. And so I'm here with Kelly about Beer Saves the World here. So.
Okay, well, I'll start out with, for each of you, what was your inspiration to like actually make a film about what you're doing?
So I've always been interested in food and agriculture. I'm not a farmer, but have done a lot of storytelling and media work around this topic, so it's always something I've been interested in. And I met Lara. One of the things they used to do on their farm was host weddings, and I just happened to attend a wedding at the farm back in 2019. And Lara was there, and we were just, you know, I just started chatting with her, asking her about her farm, because I was already interested in that. And so we just got to know each other a little bit at that time and, you know, stayed in touch very minimally over the next few years. And then I always tell this story, which was that it was in 2022 that I just, like, got this email from Lara with the subject line was, like, movie idea. And I think you could pick it up from here, but I think Lara just felt like you really wanted people to see what is actually going on a farm. And you have a lot of people come and visit the farm and do tours and all these, you know, people were really interested in it, but you were just, I think, getting the sense from visitors that, like, wow, people just have no idea what it's actually like out here running a farm. You wanted to share that. And so that's really what started the film. It grew a lot over time. It was, you know, going to be a short film at first, and then it evolved, and we realized we wanted to film throughout the four seasons and incorporate, you know, the slaughter process with the animals and then the rebirth in the spring. And so once it kind of took shape as a year-long cycle, that was kind of how it was contained. But yeah, I don't know if you want to add
sure.
to that.
Okay, so I know we're in Eugene. I love you, Eugene. So feel free to throw like beer cans at my head. But the actual, I know this is a little testy, but the actual reason that I wanted to make this film was that I think there's a point in the film where I say, like, you know, there's a lot of fencing. And I've been farming, just for context, I started farming in 1993. So I've been farming for a long time, but there was one particular day, and I think it was the day I sent Dana this email, where I changed my clothes like 4 times because it was raining so hard. You know, I was like out and fencing on the 40 acres and alone and pissed off. And I was like, God damn, you know, nobody ever really. But the real spark for me as far as an idea for the film, and this is not the direction that Dana ended up going, which was totally fine, was that, I don't know how many of you have seen, what's the movie I always talk about? The grass movie.
The Vegas Little
Farm. No, not that one. Anyway, I'll think of it. But because we raise meat, over the course of my life, I've had so many people kind of assume because I love animals so much that I'm vegan. And one of the things that sparked the idea for the film was that I really wanted to show, okay, look, you know, I wanted it to be called a love letter to my vegan friends. Dana was not into that. But I really wanted to kind of put out there, the issue isn't specifically what you eat, it's how it's grown. So if you're gonna eat, you know, if you're choosing a vegan diet because you believe that's the best thing for the planet, bless your heart, like that's amazing. But there's so much misinformation around that, and the idea that like if you don't like CAFOs, you know, if you don't like animals raised in confinement, you're gonna like throw the baby out with the bathwater and then eat soybeans produced on mass industrial farms sprayed with glyphosate that are, you know, plowing up the earth, you're not necessarily, again, like this is where I get the tomatoes thrown at me. You know, I really wanted the film to say, look, you can love, you can eat animals and not be an asshole. Like, you can eat animals and be doing something really, really precious with your land, with the environment. It's about how you farm and the size of your farm and your relationship to your animals and your community, not specifically what you're eating. But also, I think for me, the biggest issue was I just, like, I put my heart and soul into farming and dealing with people being like, what? Eggs? $10 a dozen? Real? And now I'm like, right? Funny. But you know, having to fight, so having to work so hard, but then fight so hard just to make a living like anybody else, I really wanted people to see, like, there's a bigger picture here. You know, if you're not raising your own food, it's easy to just be like, oh, this is what, you know, does that, anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was my intention, and Dana was so amazing and gracious about, I mean, there's like the number of hours of footage not in that are staggering.
It's only 1 hour
in it. Only 1 hour.
The other way around, we were actually, our group, again, Perennial Films, where we did we actually produced a feature film, and it was completed this year, and we just showed it at Climate Week in New York. Thank you very much. So we've got it's a feature film called Prairie Prophecy, and it is about regenerative farming, and it is about, but more specifically about Wes Jackson, who founded the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, and through his work and the work of all the people that he has influenced, it's just made a big, big change in the way that people think about how we farm and feed ourselves. And this is somebody who's been at it since, you know, the 1970s. And in that process, they developed out of just a natural prairie wheatgrass, that something was growing out on the prairie, taking that wheatgrass and then and hybridizing it naturally over all these decades to create a perennial grain that you saw in the beer movie called Kernza. And we just felt like it was just such a cool product, a neat, you know, something cool to talk about. It's in our feature, but our feature is just, you know, very wide and talks about regenerative, also regenerative ranching, where, you know, they're moving, you know, the different kinds of animals, especially cattle, across the plains, just like the, again, like, as we talk about, just like the buffalo used to do. And so it's good, it touches on all these things. But yeah, while making this, so for the filmmakers there, while making this big, you know, big 90-minute feature, we said, well, you know, we always thought we might do some bonus content or some other thing, and we wanted to talk a little bit about just Kernza. And so I did have this, you know, sort of idea that said, well, we should talk about it. And Kernza can be used for, you know, anything that wheat can be used for, so bread and pasta and stuff. But none of that was quite as interesting as beer. So about 10 years ago, Patagonia came along, and 40 years ago, Wes Jackson at the Land Institute, like I said, the scientists who were working on this, and also Yvonne Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia, got together and said, we're going to do something with this. And somewhere around 10 years ago, they started with beer. And it's, you know, now in the last year, it's taken off, and you guys will be able to try some, and then we'll talk a little bit more about beer later. So we did make this short movie to promote our long movie. And so any filmmakers who want to talk about that, it's been a really successful strategy, and I'm glad to talk to you about that sometime. Yeah.
What got you into doing films about regenerative farming?
Meeting the scientists. We're talking about Wes Jackson and the people. And
how'd you, like, what got you into, just think, did you do journalism? Like, what got you into
that? Well, no, just, it was specifically meeting those people in the context. You know, I'm a factual producer. And if anything, you know, any docuseries and documentaries of all types. And then somewhere around, you know, 2015, started working with a group that was the same group of people, a couple other guys who we thought we were going to do some big, big planet Earth type thing, but it was always going to be based around agriculture. Because all of us just collectively thought, you know, what is the biggest problem in the world? Well, you know, we came to agriculture. It wasn't like, well, climate change, well, yeah, but, if, you know, climate change isn't going to mean anything if we all starve to death.
It's a question for the former farmer there. What are you doing now after that? That's such a wonderful life.
Thank you for asking. Actually, I'm back on the farm. It has been a really intense year and a half, and the really short story is I'm back on the farm.
Same farm.
We that last scene, you know, the farm was on the market, and I mean, I can share this because it just is life. Derek and I are in the process of getting divorced. We're almost divorced, and a lot of that, he's a lovely person, but it's interesting to see it now, a year, you know, we're like a year into almost being divorced, but he is really sincere about, he was not a farmer. And I think that's one thing when I meet we've had tons, actually Ken, it's interesting, Ken, who's in that story, was just visiting with his fiance like 2 days ago. It was amazing. I hadn't seen him for 3 years. And it's really interesting because like all of my advice to people who come to the farm as farm interns is, if you like farming, don't try to marry someone who's never farmed. That's a bad idea. Because they really don't know what they're getting into. So I'm buying Derek out and back on the farm and kind of trying to figure it out. I kept 6 of the goats and the llamas, Finn's still there. And I have a new set of pigs. What I'm doing now is actually what I was originally doing before COVID anyway. I never really expected my livestock operation to get that big. What I do is I run homesteading classes. So I teach women's carpentry classes, and I pre-COVID was doing all sorts of cheese making. And you know, my mission in life really is just to say, like, hey, like, humans used to do some fun, cool stuff, and we can still do that. So the name of the farm has changed. It's Wade Creek Farm. I actually renamed it after Nate's middle name. So Nate Wade. And yeah, that's what we do. Nate and I are there.
Yeah.
My question's for Beer Guy.
Hey, Beer Guy!
This is going to be tough.
So my go-to daily beer is Beer Pond Pale Ale. Is there any reason why a beer like that could be made with Kernza?
Nope.
Thank you.
You know, it's a good question. I mean, the reason that you see this beer, which is being made as a lager, is that a lager is just such a clean beer to showcase the flavors of Kernza.
Okay.
Now, if you're to use that in like a stout beer or a brown ale or a red ale or anything like that, it might get lost a little bit. So in something like Mirror Pond, which is, you know, like a nice refreshing pale ale, a nice balance of hops and malts and things like that, you're definitely going to pick up some of that Kernza flavor, which when we get ready to taste it, I'll be able to tell you what you're tasting.
I have a question. Is there a follow-up movie?
Not right now.
I think it's interesting because,
Dana's done.
For anyone who's a filmmaker, yeah. It's like, the film is never the whole story. Like, it's a moment in time. It's a story that you've edited to create some kind of effect that you're hoping to. And it's not your whole life, and it never can be. And I think that was like, we struggled with that. I mean, I think you struggled with that a little bit towards the end when it was like, what are we going to do next? Well, I want people to see the next phase, and it just...
I really liked it. I appreciate it because it was so... I have seen some other, movies that on Netflix that we won't mention. But they do, it's the Instagram, story of farming.
Right.
It's not real farming. I mean, anybody who's ever worked at all knows that that's not, how it all turns out all hunky-dory. So it's, it's gritty, it's human, but I really appreciate that you decided to show it all. You show some of the bad stuff, but, just ending on that, that no, we're leaving or we're changing this or giving up, in a way, is just so authentic, and I really love that about your movie.
I have a question for the beer folk.
Beer folk. Are we moving on to beer? No.
I was wondering, so you had in the film you showed some collaborations with breweries.
Mm-hmm.
How did you select which ones you're partnering with? Were they local ones? I saw that one was in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that collaboration process
work? Yeah, in the movie you've heard Peter from Deschutes, the CEO of Deschutes, say that there's right now there's 9,500 craft brewers across the United States and only 50 organic. So that's how they were chosen. So one is Patagonia handpicked the people to make the beer to start with. And it is being made in different little markets by organic brewers. So we saw somebody in Vermont, Lawson's Brewery there. There's somebody in Chicago, but all together they're in Arizona Wilderness, which is in Gilbert, Arizona, and in Phoenix. They were hand chosen along with Topa Topa because they were the only brewers around the country that are brewing organic everything, and have a sustainable model for their breweries. And they, walk the walk and talk the talk. And what they've done, what Patagonia did was they chose them, and they each make that same Kernza recipe in their own area, and they're able to take over those areas to distribute it. And just recently, within the last year, now we have Deschutes in Bend, Oregon. Yay. They're the heroes of the story because, I saw them today. They were great. They're just doing, they are not a big brewer by any means, but they are really big for a craft brewer. But they are the only ones that brew organic beer. So they were, so now they are working towards making this a more national distribution. But the other small brewers that are brewing for Patagonia are all still there, but there's only 12 in the entire country. So that's how we picked them, because we picked three out of the 12,
You want another question? I got two questions for you.
Uh-huh.
Beer Guy, what are you doing with the spent grain? I'm sorry. The spent grain I know it's very difficult to make alcohol fuel out of spent beer grain. You have to use sulfuric acid, and it's very difficult. Is Kernza more conducive to
alcohol fuel, maybe, or what do you, and what do you do with the spent grain? And Laura, do you, have you, there was this lady in Massachusetts that heated her greenhouse with Angora rabbits. Have you thought of using the animals as a heat source, and is Angora, would we ever see a return of Angora sweaters?
No. Do you want to start?
You go ahead. That's
it. Well, it's a short answer.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the heating of the heating with animals, like, yeah, I started farming in Wisconsin, right? And so, like, the barn is the one place with all the cattle that is tolerable in the winter because it's warm. So, sure. Yeah. I don't know. Rabbits. What I was saying about rabbits, again, tomato throwing, rabbits are nature's snack food. I'm not opposed to rabbits, but they're tasty, but I don't know. Sure, come on over.
Angora goats, too, I think.
Yeah. Here's the very short but real answer to that. So I also, I'm really obsessed with, like, living in the, like, 1800s to, you know, 1980. You saw my, like, phone. I have tried to spin wool. You know what I mean? Like, I try to do that whole, like, ooh, I'm going to make everything. And then I've got bags, giant garbage bags of disgusting moth-infested wool. Like, the problem is, like, me and what are me is the honest truth. It's like, if you want to pay me a full-time salary to not have to have a full-time job off the farm and raise Angora rabbits, heck yes. Let's talk. Done and done.
All right, so let's see. The question was about spent grain, is that right? Yeah, so spent grain with Kernza is very much like a lot of the other spent grain, you know, barley and wheat and other different rye and everything like that. It's being used in, like, pizza crust. It's being used in various other food products.
Crackers.
I wish I had some right now that I could have you try.
Yeah.
But you'd be able to tell instantly all the different food products it could be used in just by the flavor alone. That's mainly what it's been being used for.
Some of the products from Kernza itself. So when you see you have a perennial plant, I mean, what the difference between that and wheat? Wheat's something that you go and you till up every year. So with Kernza, what they do is you cut off the top, and then it keeps growing. That next part, so it makes it a huge plant, and about three times longer, you know, deeper as roots. But that top, they cut off the top that goes into, you know, that grain that is used just like wheat, and then the next part of that plant is all silage, and it's all being used for animal feed.
I've got a question that Laura Ann about the Kernza grain.
Okay.
Kernza, what type of land do you have to grow that?
Could and she?
That was my first question. I was like, hey!
I think you have grown it on her.
Yeah, we were talking about that.
Yeah, that's the first thing they asked us. Actually, I don't think it's cold enough.
Yeah.
They've been trying. Kernza grows, like I said, it's a natural grass that grows in the prairie, and that's how it's been. And right now, the Kernza that you will be trying in this beer is grown in Minnesota, in western Minnesota. And the bulk of the Kernza that's coming to all the to Deschutes and all these, when you saw Luke Peterson's farm, they're in Madison, Minnesota. So with Kernza, it has to stay under the ground at a certain temperature for a long time. And the best ones, the best crops are in Wisconsin and Minnesota. They're trying it all over, but they can't grow it in California. They can't grow it a lot of places that they've tried. And, you know, they're working on it, but that's, you know, it's just like wheat grows certain places, it doesn't grow everywhere.
For the hard part, I was curious if you knew the title early on. I know you did share that you wanted to show how hard
it was. I do know how hard it was.
And the second part is, when you set up, when you, like, started making the film, did you have any idea, or, like, where it ended up, like, how did you decide where to let the story that we saw go?
Well,
I think coming up with titles is really hard. I've done a few projects where the title's just obvious from the beginning, but usually that's not my experience, and I definitely really struggled to come up with a title for this. Our editor, Sarah, who is incredible, she came up with this title, and I was like kind of testing it around, and it definitely got like mixed feedback, but overall it seemed to resonate. So we just kind of went with it. I think, yeah, so that's the story with the title. I can tell you more about it. But yeah, I mean, because, you know, we didn't want it to be too negative. Like, it's not all negative, right? Like, so that was the question there. But that's how the title came about. And then, yeah, with, like, the scope of the story, yeah, like I said, it originally started... the idea was kind of to do more of a short focusing on like regenerative cattle grazing practices.
She kept saying that, can I won't, she, Dana, the number of times Dana was like, okay, that's it, we're done filming. And that was like, and it's so cute, because she'd be like, we're done filming, but let me know if anything, if anything's coming up that would be interesting.
Well, I think, I mean, yeah, so I think after spending more time with Lara and just like getting to know her better and her, I don't know, just like really compelling and interesting ideas about the world and ways that she farms, like it was just like, I'm also somebody that makes films about humans and just that's what's interesting to me. So yeah, it was, you know, I never wanted it to be like a topic film, it was really a story. But after spending more time with her and really learning about like her process of slaughtering the animals, I knew that I wanted to film that, because I also have watched a lot of films, documentaries about food and farming, and I've never seen one that shows that, or that even really talks about it. I'm sure they're out there, but I really haven't seen it. And so that happened just a couple months after the summer cattle grazing filming that we did, and once I filmed the slaughter is when I just knew that we had to see the cycle. Like, I just had to see birth. So I was really just like waiting to complete the cycle, and I think the film would have been a lot shorter, like not feature length, if all of that didn't happen with Ella, the milk cow, which was completely unexpected, but in a way just like illustrates all of the different things that Lara and farmers deal with encapsulated in that story. And so that expanded the scope of the film. And then once we filmed the birth of the goats, that was really the last thing I wanted to show, to really complete the cycle. And then the question became like, what is the ending of the film? Like, it wasn't clear just like how the story should end. Like, what's Lara's kind of ending to this moment? You know, is it a high note? Is it a low note? Is it questioning? I mean, it's all of those things. But that was really difficult to figure out the ending. And because you were still living your life and figuring out what was gonna happen next. And so it really wasn't until a year later when you guys did decide to sell the farm that I felt like that was like the most heartbreaking, but like in a way the only way to end the film, to like really bring home the message of like, this is the reality of small farming. So it kind of like, yeah, that became the ending.
Okay.
So yeah.
This is the Kill Radio, non-corporate, non-soundbite, non-violent news. And right now this is an interview I did with Terry Wilhelm. Yamhill, Oregon, the River Newer Company, Inc. announces that it has been purchased by Terry Wilhelm. Quote, "We are happy to have this opportunity to buy this company. This comes at a time when more and more people are thinking about the high cost of gasoline and are looking to alternative fuels," said Terry Wilhelm of the Revenuer Company.
Terry Wilhelm of the River Newark Company, who manufactures alcohol stills from 5 gallon tabletop sizes to 1,000 gallon commercial plants heated by electricity, wood-fired propane, or natural gas. Quote, by enabling our customers to produce their own alcohol fuel strengthens our country's strategic position in the foreign oil industry market, according to Terry Wilhelm, owner of the Revenuer Company. Compared to gasoline, which emits carbon monoxide, alcohol emits only CO2, which is essential to plant life and water. Alcohol has a much higher octane rating, 108, than gasoline. Products like the Revenuer Company are an important part of the growing market for self-sufficiency, estimated by market research analysts to be growing rapidly in the coming years. More and more companies are using alcohol stills like this in bottom-line mission-critical applications, says Wilhelm. Revenuer stills can also be used to reclaim and purify waste solvents, thinners, acetones, and can be a major player in this arena. So this is an interview with Terry Wilhelm that I did recently. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
Who you are and what you do?
My name is Terry Wilhelm, Revenuer Company. We build all copper alcohol stills in capacity from 5 to 1,000 gallons. We're located in Oregon, and this is our 29th year of business.
But you just bought the Revenuer, I thought.
Correct. The company will actually be about 35 years old next year. The previous owners are still very much involved with the company, although not as far as the production, more on the design side.
Okay, and so you've been into alcohol for 35 years. What's the history of alcohol use? Is it true that Henry Ford originally designed his cars to run on alcohol?
Yes, that is true. And what kind of transpired towards gasoline was basically the oil companies having a byproduct that they couldn't get rid of, which is actually gasoline.
Well, when they were making kerosene.
But that's true. Henry Ford never intended the car to run on gasoline.
But, I mean, people used alcohol because they produced, that was the only way they could get fuel, was they had to produce it themselves.
Correct. And once again, we're going back a little bit before the oil companies had figured out how to do a lot different other than, like, stove oils and kerosene. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess let's go right into, cars can run on alcohol, any car can run on alcohol fuel that runs on gasoline?
Yes, it can. Brazil went to 100% about 30 years ago. To my knowledge, and I believe this is still true, they don't have any petrol cars at all. As far as conversion and anything can run, yes. Pretty much any race car you see nowadays is running on a version of some sort of an alcohol, whether it's ethanol or methanol. And that's been going on pretty much since the beginning of racing time.
Okay, so what about the new cars? I just read an article that they can put a computer chip in a car that'll adjust itself automatically for alcohol.
That's correct, too. And a few weeks ago, I looked at one of the new GMC Suburbans, which is called an all-fuel vehicle. And there's nothing that the driver needs to do, whether he's filling it up with an ethanol blend or regular gasoline. The computer sensing what it is and adjusting the timing and the fuel delivery rate.
Wow, so is that an option or is that standard?
It was standard on this vehicle just because it was an all-fuel vehicle.
So otherwise I'd have to order it from the factory, do you think, or are they sitting on showroom floors?
Well, the one I saw was it was sitting outside. That was in a large Suburban, and then looking at the Ford dealers, there are some Tauruses and some Rangers, and I haven't seen a full-size vehicle yet, but I have seen the Taurus and the Rangers on the lot.
But so where am I going to get this chip, though? Can I go down to my dealership and ask him for a computer chip?
I believe that not only is that true and that they'll probably install it, but I also believe that Superchips is now burning chips for that purpose, too. I haven't talked to them in quite a while. I know that they were looking at it several months ago.
Okay, and but if you have an old car with a carburetor, it's just a matter of changing the jetting?
Actually, an old car with a carburetor or a lawnmower or a rototiller or any of that is very easily. Something on a very small engine size, really all you're doing is screwing out the airflow metering just a little bit. Alcohol is thicker than gasoline, so you need to have a little bit more quantity going in. On a carbureted engine, the first rule of thumb is to open up the jets one-third. And if you're going to kind of fine-tune it from there, you can go from there. But that's usually the first general rule of thumb is just enlarge the jets one-third.
Okay, and then but alcohol burns faster than gasoline, right? I don't get as good a gas mileage.
Alcohol burns cleaner and hotter. Your mileage is a function of the amount of alcohol you're using. You're going to need more alcohol per gallon, but that usually typically isn't everybody's question. And what their concern is, am I going to get more mileage on alcohol than I am on gasoline? Basic answer to that is no. The other side of that is you can be making your own alcohol, usually, even if you're having to buy your products at a retail price cheaper than you're buying a gallon of gasoline.
Mm-hmm. And plus my performance is better.
Yes. Without any major modifications to your engine will perform better, although there are a lot of things you can then do to an engine that will make it respond better and more on the power side than the gasoline response.
And is there a corrosion problem with running alcohol? Does it corrode my cylinders?
No.
Earlier?
No.
There's water in gasoline also, right? Gasoline has water in it.
True. The alcohol that runs best really on a non-modified engine is somewhere in the area of 150, 160 proof. And in a lower compression engine, the amount of water that's still in that, roughly being 20-25%, has more of a cooling effect on the cylinder.
So it's going to last longer.
Correct. You'll find, if you're watching something that close on an engine that's converted, you'll find that it runs a little bit cooler, and it's also running a lot quieter.
Okay, and what about, do I have to warm the fuel still? Doesn't alcohol freeze at a lower rate than gasoline?
No, alcohol will not freeze. The problem with alcohol on a carbureted engine is when you start getting down to cold temperatures at 30, it does not want to vaporize as nicely as the gasoline will. If you're thinking about a carbureted engine, there's a couple different ways to do it. If you've set it up as dual fuel, you can always start it on gasoline and switch it over to alcohol. Or the easiest thing to do is to, and there's several ways to go about this, but to be able to just put a squirt of gasoline into the engine as you're starting it when it's cold, and then it'll run great on the alcohol.
Because it's warm by then. But this doesn't happen with fuel injection?
No. The fuel injection is, it's going in there at about 56 PSI, so it's atomizing it pretty good.
Okay, and so what about the rumor, the theory that there isn't enough biomass on the Earth? If we were to switch over totally to alcohol, would we have enough biomass to meet our needs?
Well,
I know they said that about Brazil, and they only do 10% of their land is devoted to agriculture.
Well, not only that, but in the United States, there's a lot of farmland that's not being used anymore because it just doesn't pay anything to be farmed.
And literally anything can be made in, almost anything can be made into alcohol.
Anything that'll fermentate will. Even apples on the ground rotting, and I'm saying this staying away from wood products. Any fruits, any vegetables, all the grains.
Well, but I hear even cellulose can be done with, I guess, difficulty, huh?
Yes, it can be done. There's no difficulty. You just have a few extra steps. You got to have an extractor. in order to get basically the stuff out of the alcohol before you can distill it. And it's not difficult. It's just a little bit higher price in the process than there is just making a simple corn moonshine whiskey.
Now, I've also read that this is actually, there's one article said that it's actually less polluting than electric power because they use gasoline, or less polluting than an electric car because they use gasoline to create electricity for electric, to charge electric vehicles.
Well, and then the byproduct that's coming out of an engine that's on alcohol is CO2. So the carbon dioxide basically is non-polluting at all. So the other thing that's worked pretty good, and we've heard from people that are using alcohol and the still to heat their greenhouses, so you've got the alcohol putting off carbon dioxide, and their reports is that it's really making the plants kind of take a different turn because they're actually being fed the carbon dioxide that they need rather than just getting it from the atmosphere.
Oh, because they're running the still off of alcohol fuel?
Yes, and they're heating the...
And the still is inside the greenhouse.
Right.
And so the carbon... Because plants use carbon dioxide.
Exactly.
All right, and so are there any tax incentives going on to get us to use alcohol fuel?
There are federal and there are several state. Each individual state has a little bit different things going on, but there's a federal tax credit. A lot of the states right now, the tax credit goes against your property tax instead of basically your end-of-the-year taxes. So, but it changes so much. We used to publish it in one of the books that comes with our stills, and it changes so much it's just hard to keep up with. But the easiest thing I ask people to do is just go find their state website and look around for whatever they have for credits. Or for tax breaks. Normally you'll find, if you sit down between what you get from federal incentives, if you're going to buy a still in any sort of a form of a production as a business, by the time you have the capital costs and the credits and the tax credits for producing alcohol as a fuel, before you've even turned it on, you've just about gotten yourself back to zero with your investment. So It does do real good.
I didn't, and so I just need a permit from the ATF?
Correct. It's Form 5110.74, and it's an alcohol fuel producer's permit. A small-scale operation is 0 to 50,000 gallons, and it's a free permit and takes about 62 days to get approved.
And it doesn't cost me anything?
Doesn't cost a thing.
And so I can produce 50,000 gallons at my house, basically.
Exactly.
And we talked about this before. Homeowners insurance doesn't seem to have a problem with it because it's less flammable than gasoline.
Exactly. normally, you know, if you're getting into something that kind of a production size, you're not doing it in your house. Mainly because you're talking about taking up a little bit of space if you were to. Excuse me, be producing 50,000 gallons, but yes, the permit is up to a 50,000 gallon capacity.
All right, and you've got a still that'll produce 5 gallons a day with by plugging it into an electric socket?
Yeah.
Runs off electricity or propane?
Our 5 and 10 gallons run on 110, and they're available in propane also. And then starting our 25 gallons, they're wired 240.
All right, and any suggestions on where to get biomass cheap?
You know, that varies quite a bit throughout the country. To answer that in a simple answer, no, I don't.
Well, let me put it this way, too. I was looking at the microbreweries. When I was up in Oregon, there's microbreweries, and they had all this spent grain.
Yes.
Is spent grain going to work, or has that already been taken? Has everything been taken out of it already?
No, it would work. They've used it to make the beer, and there's still starches and sugars and protein in that could be used again.
Because I just see them throw huge buckets of it away.
Yeah, they either give it away or pay people to take it away. Usually.
All right, and so what do you think about the oil wars, and how does this relate to the oil wars? Do you think we wouldn't have to go to war if we all switched to alcohol fuels? Or?
Well, we went through this back in 73 once already. There was a big jump to make alcohol due to the shortage that we had going on. I think the Bush administration and the government's pushing it from a different direction this time, rather than, it's going to take some infrastructure throughout the United States to get into alcohol anyway, but there's already an E85 blend out there, which is, there's two different ways of an E85 at 85% alcohol and an E85 at 15%. And most states now are already blending 10% alcohol into the gasoline, and that's done basically to stretch the amount of gasoline farther without doing anything so drastic that the cars need to be looked at kind of seriously as far as the full conversion over to alcohol.
Yeah, any legislators that are pro-alcohol that we should be looking at? Legislation coming up?
By name, no. Like I said, the Bush administration is really starting to push. We're seeing more and more large ethanol plants springing up throughout the U.S. than we did in the last 8 years. And the interest for us on the smaller size that we build has really drastically gone up in the last year and a half.
So it's on the rise?
Yeah, looking at our numbers from the last 12 months previous to the previous 12 months, our sales have gone up 30 times.
Is that right? And so what's involved in getting a still from you? You ship it to the person?
Right. Normally, 5, 10, and 25-gallon stills, we normally try and keep in stock so that they can be shipped immediately. Although it's been pretty difficult, and with the holiday season, it's been really difficult to kind of keep up with the demands. So it's a little seasonal for us, and it has a tendency to taper off and be able to get caught back up. But yes, if somebody calls us up and buys it and pays for it, and we discuss pretty much how soon or how they want it as far as shipped. Our 5-gallon still actually goes out in a cardboard box, and it can pretty much be shipped anyway. The 10 gallons on up are put in wooden crates and are shipped freight.
And is there a lot of assembly involved?
No, you can pretty much put just about any size still up to the 300-gallon together with 2 8-inch adjustable wrenches. Mm-hmm.
And then you sell all the equipment and supplies that go with it?
Yes.
Mash recipes?
Yes. Every still that we sell has a 208-page book that has recipes in it for making the mash, information about converting cars, has a copy of the permit, talks about using different products to make alcohol, some history of the alcohol. And then also every still we provide a pound and a half of yeast, alcohol hydrometer, which is 0 to 200 proof, a triple scale hydrometer, a vinometer, a beaker, and pH test strips for you to check the water. So when it comes to you, the only thing you need to do is buy a sack of corn and a sack of sugar and mix it up according to what we recommend for a recipe.
Wow. And I see your smallest one is $1,000, which that's, and it's all made out of copper.
Correct.
So that's a pretty good deal.
Something that I try and keep people to keep in mind, our 5-gallon still functions the exact same way as a 1,000-gallon still. So if they're a little hesitant about the money situation, buy a 5 or 10-gallon still and see how it works and how it functions and get comfortable with it. And providing that it's in a fairly decent shape, we always take our stills back into trade for usually the full price if they're in good shape in order to upgrade to the whatever, next size or several sizes up from that. So I try and keep it so that if $1,000 is easy for you to do to get into it and think that, someday I want something 10 times as big, you know, then spend $1,000 and play around with it and see, okay, this is how it works. And like I said, if it's, we've taken back some pretty rough ones on trade. Granted, they didn't come back at full purchase price, but we'll always take them back on trade.
And then, so what's involved in a large still? You will come out to the site and do a turnkey operation?
If that's what's needed, sure. And that's usually something in a large system, like a 1,000-gallon still or larger. One, it's several months planning and several months in the production phase, too. So on-site setup is certainly something that we'll offer if the person needs.
But you said you beat someone's price. I can't remember what it was. Where you just set up several thousand gallon stills in a row, and you beat someone's. Whose price was it? Not Archer Daniels Midland.
Well, the thing that we try and do as a company is to cater more towards the people that are looking something on the smaller size. Our 1,000-gallon still system will produce 100,000 gallons a year. 24 hours a day running. If 100,000 gallons isn't enough and you need to get up to 1 million gallons, what we do is we just start taking our 1,000-gallon stills and modularly build them together. There are several companies out there, and not to name them, they're easy to find, that will put together a system for you that will make 1 million gallons a year on up. The other side of that is they're looking at 10 to 15 million to put the plant together and usually 3 or 4 years to build it. Our 100,000 gallon a year system right now is 109,000, and we should be able to put that together and have it set up in 6 months' time.
All right, and then just out of curiosity, all this technology comes from moonshiners, right? Where was this invented? Was this invented during Prohibition, or it's been around longer than that, I guess?
Oh, the Egyptians were making beer and alcohol.
But I mean, were you a moonshiner? Can you say that?
Well, no, I wasn't. I'm still a little too young for that, but there are three generations of moonshiners in the family, so
okay.
We'll probably leave it at that.
All right, so Terry Wilhelm of the Revenuer Alcohol Stillmaker. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is the Kill Radio non-corporate, non-soundbite, non-violent news podcast.